Okay, Boker Tov. Good morning and welcome to Narki Street. Shabbat morning, the Bible study. It's the 20th of January, 2018, and we're continuing in the Trino Parasha. And our text this morning is from Leviticus 23, verses 9 to 14. And the Haftarah is Joel 4, verses 13 to 21 in the Hebrew, which in the English is just the chapter before Joel 3, 13 to 21. So I think the discrepancy there is because of the Septuagint, but it doesn't matter. So let's start in prayer. Lord, we thank you for this morning. And thank you for the rain we've had this week and the rain yet to come. And thank you for how it represents your grace, your mercy for this land, for the peoples that live here, and that you care about each one of us. You care about your creation and your creatures, and we are humbled by it, and we just ask that you would speak to us this morning from your word. In your name we pray. Amen.
I have more than an inch and a half of rain down here on the desert already. That's probably 2 days.
Wow. Yeah, I think it's going to get even more this week. So. Okay, so.
You said Joel?
Yes.
Joel?
Yes, Joel.
There is no Joel 4.
Yeah,
right. You followed it. English is 3. In Hebrew, it's 4.
Arabic is 3.
Yeah.
It's in
chapter 3.
See up there, it says 3.
Because in Hebrew, it's numbered different in the Hebrew.
So your numbering comes from the Greek, so just like ours does.
Not the English does.
Right. So let's start in Leviticus, Vayikra, chapter 23. Last week, Sharon started. She had a bit of chapter 23 in hers,
uh-huh.
And I'm going to continue from there.
Okay, we had up to Pesach.
That's right.
And Chag HaMatzot.
So let's. I'll just read it since it's so small. Leviticus 23, verse 9. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you enter the land I'm going to give you and you reap its harvest, bring to the priest a sheaf of the first grain you harvest. He is to wave the sheaf before the Lord so that it will be accepted on your behalf. The priest is to wave it on the day after the Shabbat. On the day you wave the sheaf, you must sacrifice, as a burnt offering to the Lord, a lamb a year old without defect, together with its grain offering of 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, an offering made to the Lord by fire, a pleasing aroma, and its drink offering of 1/4 of a hin of wine. You must not eat any bread or roasted or new grain until the very day you bring this offering to your God. This is to be a lasting ordinance for the generations to come wherever you live." So, to start off, what are we reading here? What is this?
My title says First Fruits.
Okay, good. First Fruits. In Hebrew, what's the word for first fruits?
Well,
Bikurim.
Bikurim. But it's not mentioned here. Bikurim. Or first fruits. And so where is it mentioned about this offering of first fruits in the Bible? Yeah. Well, for instance, if you go to Exodus 23:15. Exodus 23:15. I Actually, I don't have Bikurim here either.
Chagakatir? Bikurei Maasecha.
Yeah, okay. So,
16, celebrate the Feast of Harvest with the first fruits of the crops you sowed in your field.
Yes, thank you. So, that is talking about Shavuot. And what crops are you bringing in for Shavuot? What's the one?
Wheat.
Yes.
Oh, no, you're right. It's like 2 months later.
So barley comes in with Pesach.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Barley comes
or
first.
2 months earlier.
That's Pesach. Right. And Shavuot, or the Feast of Harvest, is the wheat. And then the next one there in 23:16 says the Feast of Ingathering,
which is Sukkot.
Which is Sukkot. And what are kinds of foods are those?
Corn?
They didn't have corn here.
Right, you're getting like towards dates. What are the other major ones?
Pomegranates.
Think about the seven species.
Yeah, grapes.
Figs. Vine.
Yes, grapes. Grapes is a big one in the Bible, right? Because there's always this idea of the juice of the grapes, the new wine, the wine. It's a big deal. So, yeah, definitely think about the grapes here. So, let's go back to Leviticus 23 again. And you kind of have to look at what you did last week with Sharon. What time of the year are we talking about here with the first fruits?
50 days after Pesach, so early, late spring,
or
early summer.
No, Shavuot is, you're right about that. But first fruits, it says, when's it going to be? It's going to be, what day do you wave this? Do you bring it to the priest? On the day, in verse 11, on the day after the Shabbat. And so, but if you look at prior, in verse 4...
That's the day after Pesach.
That's right.
Right.
Well, the day after Pesach is the unleavened bread, the day, right. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, right? Because go to verse 4, verse 5.
Well,
the Lord's Pesach begins at twilight on the 14th day of the first month.
Right.
On the 15th day, so that's the next day of that month, the Lord's Feast of Unleavened Bread begins, so Matzot, right? And that's for 7 days. And then, first fruits comes the day after the Shabbat, after this whole thing.
Right.
But today in Judaism, rabbinic tradition, when does the first fruits happen? It's the second day after Pesach. It's been, what's the word?
Contracted.
Or frozen, or it's been brought together in one place on the calendar. Because if it's the day after Shabbat, everybody knows the Jewish calendar is lunar, so it changes every year. And so sometimes the first fruits can fall 3, 4, 5 days after.
Well, I guess it depends if you interpret the Shabbat of the Chag or just the normal Shabbat.
No, it's the Shabbat after the Chag.
Right, but I'm saying the Chag might fall Tuesday to Tuesday, and then those Tuesdays are Shabbat. So it's not talking about Shabbat Saturday.
No, but it's
talking about Shabbat.
No, here it is talking about Shabbat Saturday.
Oh, yeah, why? I mean, couldn't it be both?
That's the dilemma here, because that's why, I mean, correctly, you have 3 days off, you celebrate, you begin counting the Omer, you begin doing all these things on the day after the Shabbat, after the holiday. So if the holiday fell, let's say, on a Wednesday, you don't start counting until the following Sunday, which is why with us, it's the only Christian tradition which follows correctly, which is why Pentecost always falls on a Sunday.
Right.
Whereas here, Shavuot does not always fall on a Sunday, because, like you say, Jewish tradition has somehow contracted it or
solidified it or...
Because what we read last week, after the Pesach, you have Chag HaMatzot.
Right.
That the first day of the Chag is a Shabbat, and the last day is a Shabbat. So if you want to count from that Shabbat, the day after that Shabbat, that would be shifting every year, right? Because the Chag might fall Wednesday to Wednesday, and then that Wednesday would be Shabbat, and you count from after that.
No, but it would be that Wednesday, then there would be Friday. For instance, I was just reading in Lois's first book, Lois de Verberg's first book, and she has like two pages on
the
Bikurim. And she's quoting from another book on Ezekiel by a guy from T.N.T. Clark. But if in the calendar, according to when Jesus died, because according to Christian tradition, Jesus died when? Like what day of the week?
Friday.
Well, I mean, I guess if you base it off the Synoptic Gospels or John, but if you base it off of the Synoptic Gospels, he died on Pesach.
Right, absolutely.
Oh, I mean, sorry, not Pesach. John hasn't died on Pesach.
He died on Friday.
Yeah, he had Pesach, right? They had the supper together. Well, anyways, I'm telling you what the Synoptic Gospels have. So that's called Monday, Thursday in the Christian calendar. The next day is what? Good Friday, because that's the day he's crucified. And then you have Shabbat, where everybody's home doing their thing. And then he raises on the first day of the week, the next morning.
Or Erev Shabbat.
And according to the calendar at that time, the first fruits would have happened when? Like, what did we just read here in Leviticus 23?
On the Sunday.
On the first day after the Shabbat. Yeah, so that's Sunday. So it's an interesting coincidence. Because Paul,
I mean, I still see it as...
Right, because Paul uses that about that Jesus, Paul, the first fruits.
Paul,
right?
Uses it when Jesus resurrects from the dead, 1 Corinthians 15. What does he say? Jesus was the Bikurim, the first fruits for the rest of us, his resurrection of the dead. It's very interesting.
I have no problem with that at all. I think that's absolutely right. I just think
that
the counting is wrong. I think he died on... I think the real Shabbat of Passover fell on a Thursday. He died on Wednesday afternoon. Otherwise, he's not 3 days and three nights.
I don't agree with that.
Well, before you say it has to be that way, the one thing to consider is that in biblical counting, a day is not 24 hours. If, like, you have kings who say in their second year, well, if they have reigned 1 year and 1 day, that's considered second year. So when you say 3 days, as long as you have a bit of 3 days, it counts as 3 days.
Tell them the Zakovich story.
It's too long. Huh?
No, just go ahead.
Okay, so I'm sitting in a class with Yair Zakovich and Serge Ruza. So Yair was my advisor and Serge was Gary's. Serge is a New Testament person. Yair is the Old Testament. And they're doing a course.
Yeah.
They're teaching a course on the Gospel of
John.
And through the eyes of Bible, right? And so Yair comes to it from the Bible. He has no background in New Testament secondary literature, you know, what everybody says about. And so we get to this thing about Jesus being dead 3 days, and so it was like, oh, okay, wait, so what's the problem here? And so Serge is explaining, well, if he dies on Friday and he rises on Sunday, there's not enough time, there's no 72 hours, you know, that can't be the 3 days. He's like, wait, what? It's got to be 3 days? So when did he die? I'm like, well, according to the Synoptics, this or this.
He died in the afternoon.
Friday. He goes, okay, that's 1 day. And he's the great Shabbat, okay.
2 days.
And then Sunday, Motzei Shabbat, whatever. He's like, that's 3 days. Biblically, that's no problem at all. That's absolutely 3 days. And like, there's no problem here.
Explain to John the word day of preparation. That's mentioned. That's why a lot of us think
it was
Wednesday or Thursday.
No, but that's the thing is if you read the Gospels, John has it happening on a different day.
John wants to highlight the fact that Jesus is a Pesach man. So there is some things, there are some reasons you could claim that they're doing it different than the rabbinic Judaism. I'm not saying it had to be that he died Friday. I'm just saying if you take it for face value that he died on Friday and rose sometime Sunday, according to Jewish calculations, which could even be Saturday night,
after the sun went down,
it's still technically 3 days when you count biblically.
Jewish.
According to biblical Jewish ideas, it's 3 days. So,
I'd always got fixated on the
so there's no problem there.
His supper with the disciples the day before the rest of the Jews had the Passover.
It's possible.
That's definite, right?
No.
It's not definite at all.
Nothing's
it's possible. It's not definite. Because there's conflicting data in the Gospels. That makes.
But he died the day after he had the Lord's Supper because it was through.
That's
the
true. Yeah, that's true.
Right.
So that's
when I. What is interesting is that for 2,000 years it was always called the Last Supper,
mm-hmm.
and then in much more recent times it's suddenly become that he was actually celebrating Passover.
Can we ask the rooster from that?
Anyways, I think we're going off a bit.
Yeah, we're going off a bit, because that really, you could have two Bible studies there on just those topics.
We'll save it for March. So, right, yeah, it's end of March.
April 1st is Easter and Passover this year. Again, they match up.
So here's where we are. We're talking about the first fruits, and in the first fruits of what? It's right after Pesach. So which grain are we talking about here?
Wheat.
No.
Barley.
Okay. Great, because wheat is with Shavuot. Okay. And a good way to kind of keep all of this together is to read the book of Ruth.
Yeah.
Because if you remember the story of Ruth. Ruth comes with her mother-in-law back to the land, to Bethlehem. And it says in chapter 2, when does she come? She arrives in Bethlehem at the barley harvest. And then later on it talks about, you know, the wheat harvest in the book.
How about oats?
Oats? Isn't that a Scottish thing?
I think it's like wheat. I say it's like wheat.
Yeah, I don't...
Midwestern America.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't think they have oats here.
Yeah, maybe they're not.
Yeah, maybe they've imported them. But so we're talking about barley here. That's one important thing I want to bring up. And so maybe let's read Joel. Joel 4. Yeah.
Before you go on, can I have the text which says Christ's first fruits is risen from the dead?
1 Corinthians 15. 1 Corinthians 15:20. Okay, so in English, Joel 3, if someone wants to read starting in verse 13.
Where's it near again? I can never find
Joel. Joel, it's right before Amos.
In the minor prophet, towards the end.
Yeah.
Hosea, Joel, Amos.
Hosea, Joel.
You want to read?
Okay. Starting when?
13.
3:13 in English, right. Put in the sickle for the harvest is ripe. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Put in the sickle for the harvest is ripe. Come, go down, for the winepress is full, the vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon will grow dark, and the stars will diminish their brightness. The Lord will also roar from Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. The heavens and earth will shake, that the Lord will be a shelter for his people and the strength of the children of Israel. So you shall know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then Jerusalem shall be holy, and no alien shall ever pass through her again. And it will come to pass in that day that the mountains shall drip with new wine, the hills shall flow with milk, and all the brooks of Judah shall be flooded with water. A fountain shall flow from the house of the Lord and water the valley of Acacias. Egypt shall be a desolation, and Edom a desolate wilderness, because of the violence against the people of Judah, for they shed innocent blood in their land. But Judah shall abide forever, and Jerusalem from generation to generation. For I will acquit them of the guilt of bloodshed, whom I had not acquitted, for the Lord dwells in Zion.
And then at verse 17, she said, pass through, mine says, in vain.
Hmm.
Pass through on what?
Pass through her again. Yes. Yeah. You've got in vain.
Which verse?
Can I not 17. Pass through again? Okay.
That's very good. No alien should ever pass through her again. And you've got
but it says, Ya'avruva. So it doesn't necessarily mean invade.
It means pass through, doesn't it?
It does mean pass through, yes.
Gentiles are not going to come again. And,
okay, well, let's talk about this context here. What are we looking at? Why is this passage connected to Leviticus 23?
Harvest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Katia is your word here for harvest. and just like you have in Leviticus 23. And it's not just talking about something that you're going to, like a grain you're going to cut, but it also is talking about what other fruit?
Grapes.
Wine.
Grapes, right? Wine.
Wine, that's it.
Wine comes from grapes. And who's going to be...
Stomp.
I mean, what is this harvest? What's this harvest talking about here in Joel?
I think it's a judgment, right? You know, good and bad, isn't it?
Okay, so a judgment. And why do you think good and bad?
That's overflowing in wickedness.
Yes.
Great.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Like this, it's like almost like evil's being harvested here. Mm-hmm. Or what you could even say is you will know them by their fruit. Right? Mm-hmm. Jesus says, you know, you taste the fruit and you know if it's good or rotten.
That's the famous battle hymn of the Republic verse. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. They shall trample out the vineyard where the grapes of wrath are stored.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a great book called Grapes of Wrath.
Yes.
But the interesting thing is that the element of judgment or evil or whatever is around decision making, which seems to be...
Well, wait. It depends who's making the decision here. Because the evil, if you follow the metaphor, it's that the fruit is bad. And so when you stomp it, you're punishing that grape. That grape gets squashed, and then their badness comes out. But that punishment is the decision, right? That's the decisive factor. Where it's God's judgment. That's the decision going on. It's not the person's judgment. I mean, obviously, to do the bad thing was bad judgment.
If you go to the verse before, let the nations be awakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat.
Uh-huh.
But there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Jehoshaphat is to judge, isn't it? And then...
No, God is to judge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, he's God, saying the word. Oh. Come up the word.
It's the valley of God's judgment there.
Yeah,
right?
That's, yeah.
So there will sit the judgment. Put in the sickle for the harvest to dry. So the judgment, let the nations wake up because I'm coming to judge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's do that. Let's back up, go to the first verse of the chapter of Joel 3. Let's get more context.
Right, but behold, in those days and at that time, when I bring back the captives of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I will enter into judgment with them there on account of my people, my heritage Israel, whom they scattered among the nations. They've also divided up my land.
Okay.
And use this capitalism as his fortunes of Judah brought back.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. Go down to verse 9. Proclaim this among the nations. Prepare for war. Rouse the warriors. Let all the fighting men draw near and attack. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. What's that verse remind us of?
Isaiah
2. What's it say in Isaiah 2? Music connect with Christmas and Jesus.
They will beat their swords into
plowshares.
Yeah.
So
they won't learn war anymore.
Right. So Joel's flipped it. He has it. Where in Isaiah, war is a bad thing. Here in Joel, he's saying it's a good thing. Why?
You're not the wicked.
Because it's judgment.
Yeah. He's not even saying it's a good thing. He's saying prepare for this battle that is coming. This judgment that is coming, isn't he?
Yeah. Right. What also do we have in Isaiah 2? If you have a finger, you can look there. What else is happening besides making peace and not war? What's going to happen from the house of, you know, the house of God? And
all the nations come and they learn the Torah?
Yeah, all the nations are coming, but in peace. They're coming up to Jerusalem in peace.
The nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore.
But in Joel, it seems like all the nations are coming up to Jerusalem for war. What is going to, in Isaiah 2, what's going to come out of Zion?
the Lord. The Torah is
coming out of Zion. And then back in Joel, what is coming out of Jerusalem? If you go to verse 18, Joel 3, 18. It says, a fountain, Mayan, will flow out of the Lord's house and will water the valley of the acacias. So it's interesting. It's like Joel and Isaiah, Joel 3 and Isaiah 2 are very, they must have been connected somehow, because they're like dancing with each other, with similar concepts, but with different points of view. Okay, but now I want to back it up even further in Joel. What is the whole context of the book of Joel? We talked about it a year ago, I think. Joel's a strange book. First off, where's Joel from? Who is he? I believe he's the only prophet that we don't know anything about except his dad. Like, we don't know where he comes from in the land. We don't know who the kings was that he was alive during. And so it's always been a great guessing game for Pete scholars to try to understand Joel's context. And there's also something else I find strange about Joel, but I'll say that in a second. What is Joel talking about in his little book here, his prophecy? What's the big problem in the land? You see it right there in the first verses. It's pretty simple.
Well, there's been a swarm of locusts.
That's it.
And the land has been eaten up.
And so that means what?
And that's a sort of judgment that's come on them already.
A nation has invaded.
There's famine, and I don't know what
right, else. Famine. I mean, that's the bottom line. There's famine.
Right.
What is Leviticus 23 about that we just read?
The first verse.
And if there's a famine, there,
how do you bring your
there are no first fruits.
How do you get famine?
No, you just read the whole thing.
But once you think that that's a metaphor, because in verse 6, you know, it's a nation that's invaded your land. So
no,
is the locust the nation?
The nation are, I mean, it depends how you interpret it. But yeah, the nation, it's these locusts. You know, it's like in Proverbs. It says, how do the locusts who have no general, how do they go in formation and do their thing.
Right, so they're a natural metaphor for armies.
Right, right.
So what I'm saying is, are you saying that the context of Joel is a natural disaster,
yes,
or is it an army disaster?
I'm saying that you're right, some people have interpreted as the locusts represent the Gentiles or whatever, and I'm not saying that they don't, because chapter 3 is talking about the Gentiles, the nations, but I'm also saying I can also see it in the natural sense, that a lot of locusts showed up and ate everything and caused famine, because it's
war causes famine
right,
as well, because
right,
you can't, there's no stability.
So whether it's actual, I mean, I'm not very good on metaphors, but if it's locusts that are coming in,
yeah,
and it's very, that's very strong here. Yeah, I think chewing locusts left, the swarming locusts has eaten, the swarming locusts left, the crawling locusts has eaten. I mean,
it talks about four different locusts.
They're quite nasty creatures doing whatever they've done. They've led famine and disaster. And if this word locust is a metaphor or a euphemism or something for Gentile nations, four Gentile nations
right,
who come in and done exactly the same damage, we're actually talking about the same thing. It doesn't actually matter on one level.
Right. I mean, it has the same results. Is
right.
What it's, right. But regarding Leviticus 23 and the first fruits, just look in Joel 1, verse 8. Mourn like a virgin in sackcloth, grieving for the husband of her youth. Grain offerings and drink offerings are cut off from the house of the Lord. Joel 1:8. What's cut off from the house of the Lord? Yeah. And if you go back to what we read in Leviticus 23, I think it's verse 14. It says when you, 13. It says, on the day that you're going to wave your first fruits before the Lord, verse 13 of Leviticus 23, it says, you also bring a grain offering and a drink offering. So Joel is just, you know, he's pointing out the obvious. If you don't have food, you don't have first fruits because the first fruits don't exist.
The priests are starving.
The priests are starving.
They're in mourning or fasting.
Verse 10 of Joel, the fields are ruined, the ground is dried up, the grain is destroyed, the new wine is dried up. Verse 11, despair, you farmers, wail, you vine growers, grieve for the wheat and the barley, because the harvest of the field is destroyed. And, you know, it fills it up. You know, it says the fig tree is withered, the pomegranate, the palm, the apple tree, all the trees of the field are dried up. Surely the joy of mankind is withered away. And he mentions joy a few times, and you think about harvest and joy, because they go together. Where does it say we will go up with joy?
We shall go up with joy.
No, sorry, not that one. With our sheaves. Bringing in the sheaves.
Bringing in the sheaves. Psalm 126 or 27.
Is it 126?
27, maybe.
Yeah, it's
joy comes in the morning. The interesting thing is, if you go back in Joel, I mean, if the... We're told to bring in these first fruits, and because of these locusts that have come in and destroyed all, we can't bring them in. Okay, there's no food left, and the result is this terrible weeping that we can't do what we've been asked to do. And there's also a sense of be ashamed, you farmers, verse 11. Because it's like this enemy that has come in, whether it's the locust or whether it's the goyim, the army of nations. It's like we've been responsible because we haven't woken up. We haven't been faithful to the Lord. Well, and it starts at the very beginning. Give ear all you have. Tell your children about it. Let people know what it is.
Right. But the thing is with Joel, is I brought this up last time, and you can try to prove me wrong, but Joel doesn't say anything about sin. He doesn't say anything about you did this wrong, you did that wrong. It just happens. And it's open to interpretation of why did it happen. Probably the normal assumption is, well, a bad thing happened because I did something bad. But Joel's an interesting book.
Well, we do have turn to me with all your heart, with fasting and weeping in
right.
the morning.
No.
So rend your heart, not your garments.
Yeah, exactly. This bad thing's happening, so we need to fast. We need to, you know, the whole thing that's associated with
right.
returning to God. But right. it doesn't talk about, oh, you chased idols, or you did this.
No.
It's interesting. Like, it's like they're trying to figure out, what did we do wrong? Why is this happening? So we're going to do whatever we can, because otherwise we're going to starve to death. I think it's great, because a lot of times in life, we're not sure why cancer happened, or why this... And we can sit there and think, oh, maybe I did this, or so-and-so did this, but sometimes we just don't know. But it's still right to return to the Lord
That's
and
right.
seek His face.
That's right.
But it doesn't mean, you know, you brought it upon yourself. You just, I mean, you can always go back to original sin and say, I'm a sinner, but it still leaves you with that. You're just humbled by what's happened to you, and you're trying to get... back to God, whatever that means.
I got your Psalm 126.
Can you read it? Read the whole Psalm.
Whole Psalm 126?
Yep. Psalm 126.
When the Lord brought back the captives of Zion, we were like men who dreamed. Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Then it was said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them, the Lord has done great things for us, and we are filled with joy. Restore our fortunes, O Lord, like streams in the Negev. Those who sow in tears will reap the songs of joy. He who goes out weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with him.
So
those who sow in tears shall reap.
So that joy associated with the harvest, because you're going to eat food, and usually people get happy when they eat. especially if they're hungry.
Especially if it's good food.
Especially if it's good food. Yeah.
Sure. These are all rina, whereas in Joel it's hason, but same conceptual joy world.
Jimma, you mentioned about rending your heart. That's in Joel, is it 2:13? Rend your heart and not your garments. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love. And he relents from sending calamity. What's that referring back to in the Bible? It's a very famous description of God. The Lord God, he is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in love.
No.
Well, yeah, Jonah also quotes from it.
It's Exodus.
It's Sinai, right? Exodus.
God showing his character to Moses.
God shows himself to Moses, and this is the line of God's character. He's gracious, compassionate. Even though these locusts are killing all my food, he's slow to anger, abounding in love. And we're all starving, but and he relents from sending calamity. But calamity just came. Verse 14, who knows? He may turn and relent and leave behind a blessing. What's that blessing?
Verse 14 of what?
Joel 2:14.
2:14, okay.
What is the blessing that God might leave behind?
A grain offering.
Food?
So again, it kind of goes back to Leviticus 23 with the first fruits. That when you have your grain offering and when you have your drink offering, that means that the locusts haven't eaten your food. And that's the other thing too, is like as you're beginning your harvest, it's a time where, okay, I hope I get my harvest in and I don't lose too much to locusts or birds, or say there's a bunch of hail that shows up one day and kills some of it. So it's kind of like this time of like we're going to harvest and hopefully we're going to get it done as soon as possible. And this is our way of bringing it to the temple and to the Lord.
And verse 14 is Jonah is the same wording.
Right.
Mi yodea, yeshuv v'nicham.
Jonah 4.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Malachim say it. Mi yodea, yeshuv v'nicham ha'elohim v'lo mivad.
That's right, sorry.
Earlier.
I was looking at verse 13. So rend your hearts and not your garments. Because the tearing of garments is what you do at the funeral,
mourning,
and so on. And I don't want that. I want your hearts to be, I don't know, we're back at circumcised again, almost.
Yeah. And Joel, you had mentioned judgment earlier, about when we were reading the Haftarah in Joel 4. You know, like there in Joel 2, verse 1, what's it say there?
Joel 2, verse 1?
Uh-huh.
Blow the trumpet and Zion, sound an alarm in my holy mountain.
Blow the trumpet, verse 15.
Blow the trumpet.
When do you blow a trumpet?
Declare a fast. Call the assembly. War. Sound a warning.
Yeah, usually it's like war. It's emergency.
Warning.
It's
gathering an assembly for some important thing.
Yeah, so this whole idea.
You go to Bethlehem
Christmas. That's right.
Have a silver trumpet.
Now, one other thing I want to point out here is where is this whole judgment happening in Joel 3?
Valley of Jehoshaphat.
Valley of Jehoshaphat. It's also called the Valley of what?
Harut.
I read it right. Harut's decision is one translation. I think that's what is here in the NIV. Do you have other translations? It'd be Joel 3:14. I have Valley of Decision. Anyone else? Randy, how would you translate that?
I'm not at your verse. What the verse?
14:3:14.
It is Emek Ha-Ha-Ha-Ut.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I would assume he's Chinese and he was saying the Valley of the Pioneer. But I would just say a steep valley. Harut is something cut. So maybe it's like a ravine.
Well, I have another one. I'm thinking calling it the Valley of the Threshing.
Of the what?
threshing.
The sledging. Because, and there's a few instances in Isaiah 28:27 where it talks about Lo behavut yudash ketach het resh vav tamech. Isaiah 28:27, Isaiah 41:15, Amos 1:3, and Job 41:30.
Is this a good imbalance? Is that right?
I read that somewhere, but I don't know.
About the revelations and the blood will flow deep. That's Joseph too, isn't it?
I mean, it doesn't say that in Revelation, but I think people have conflated, like, Armageddon or something.
Fix that with the river and the cut and the steep and everything.
Right. But, yeah. So in those four instances, harut is this idea of a threshing sledge.
Like a morag.
So I'll just read them in English here. Certainly caraway seed is not threshed with a sledge.
Ketzach is not
caraway. Right.
Okay, I'm sorry. Ketzach is poppy.
Nigella.
No, I know. What do you call it in English?
Black. It's nigella in the Latin term.
I think they call it black
cumin seed.
Black cumin.
I don't know, the little black one.
I know. Like a teardrop.
I think they just.
Nigella is the Latin thing. Or caraway is like a skinny moon.
But the thing is, it can't be black. Well, I mean, I guess it could be. But here in it talks about Ketzach.
And Kamon.
And then it talks about Kamon.
Right.
So.
Because they're two spices.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Okay, look at the next one. Isaiah 41:15. Look, I am making you like a sharp threshing sledge, new and double-edged. You will thresh the mountains and crush them. You will make the hills like straw.
I'm not so much in the text, but I'm lost in where we're going. Because the black cumin is not threshed with a threshing sledge.
Right.
Yes.
Nor is a cartwheel rolled over the cumin. What's that got to do with where we were?
You're talking about the word
harut? Harut is a threshing sledge that you have.
The tool that they use.
So some things you thresh and some things you don't thresh.
Well, he's just saying the valley is called the valley of the threshing or something.
The threshing sledge. But if you want, the Net Bible says because the cumin seed and the ketzach are too small to thresh with a sled, so
right.
That's why you'd use some kind of stick. I don't know.
Yeah, we don't need to talk about seeds. I'm sorry. It's
the
main point is that
it's a threshing sledge in
that this valley of decision is how the NIV has it. It could be this, as you brought up to begin with, is judgment. Judgment is associated with threshing.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm trying to go with. With these four examples, it has this word that's used for decision, valley decision. It's actually translated as threshing. That's my point. So, is that clear?
And if there is a connection then, these very small things, these seeds and come in and whatever, don't need to be threshed.
They need a different system to thresh it, but that's not the connection. The connection is the word harut.
Yeah. And what I want to get to here is now in the New Testament, where do we have these images and these metaphors of judgment connected to harvest? Okay, we'll save Revelation since it's at the last, but like let's start with the Gospels. Jesus.
Wither out in the harvest field, and it comes at the end of time, and something will get
a so go to Matthew 13.
The evil ones will be rolled away like the chaff.
Yeah. He had a Moagula. Mm-hmm. Well, we could start with John the Baptist, right? Let's see. What does John like to say? Well, he says the axe is already at the root of the trees, and every tree that does not produce good fruit will be cut down. But oh, here it is. Verse 12. This is Matthew 3:12. Sorry, I just skipped back. Matthew 3:12. His winnowing fork is in his hand, and he will clear his threshing floor, gathering his wheat into the barn, and burning up the chaff with unquenchable fire. So this is John the Baptist talking about Jesus. Was that? Okay, now. It's just a bad thing.
Yeah, but here it really consists of the fact that threshing is for a purpose.
Separation.
Separate the good from the bad. And so that goes back to the deeper connection of judgment. Judgment is making a judgment, you know, about
a decision.
And the decision. And
yeah.
So
yeah. So it kind of follows there in Matthew 13 with the parable of the tares. Matthew 13. The kingdom, verse 24, the kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. When the wheat sprouted and formed heads, then the weeds also appeared. And then there's this whole discussion between the owner and his servants about, well, should we go ahead and just pull up the weeds? But no, because that will you'll pull up some of the good wheat if you do that. Just wait till the end. We'll, everything gets chopped at the same time, and then we'll do the separation. Now, if you go to the explanation of this parable in Matthew 13, it's in verse 36. His disciples said, you know, tell us the meaning of this parable. And so he said, the one who sowed the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed stands for the sons of the kingdom. The weeds are the sons of the evil one, and the enemy who sows them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the harvesters are angels. As the weeds are pulled up and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will weed out of his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. They will throw them into the fiery furnace where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And so, you have this idea, if you go back to Joel 3 where we were looking before, where it's talking about, you know, put your sickle into the harvest. There's grapes, there's juice coming out of the wine vats. And it's basically a harvest of evil, right? That's what it said in Joel 3, was it 13? So, and here, it says here that this, the Son of Man is going to weed out of his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. So, on one hand, they're kind of like, it's kind of a conflicting metaphor, because Joel's saying the harvest, well, maybe it's not conflicting, but the harvest is evil in the case with Joel. And here, there is some evil being harvested, which I guess are the weeds, and then there's the righteous being harvested at the same time.
So, can I say something about this word?
Yeah.
I've got what I think is the correct word, which is tares, and a tare is a counterfeit plant,
yeah,
or a counterfeit wheat. And one of it is very hard to actually recognize,
yeah,
and it grows up to, normally when a wheat gets to full flowering, its head drops down with the weight of the corn or whatever it is in it.
Right.
Whereas the tare stands absolutely rigidly upright. So you don't really know until the time of the harvest
which is which.
Which is which. Well, that's why you have to leave it, because you can't just take a risk and drag out these weeds, because
it could be wheat. Yeah.
You know. Mm-hmm. And you can spiritualize it quite a long way, what that means. But the whole thing about it.
Okay, especially because the good part bows.
That's right, that's part of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The color
becomes that.
Which? The tear. Yeah.
Yeah, so Nadine here is talking about the color. And so if you were to look at John 4, verse 34, verse 35, Jesus says, "Do you not say 4 months more and then the harvest? I tell you, open your eyes and look at the fields. They are ripe for harvest. Even now the reaper draws his wages. Even now he harvests the crop for eternal life, so that the sower and the reaper may be glad together. Thus the saying, 'One sows and another reaps,' is true. I sent you to reap what you have not worked for. Others have done the hard work, and you have reaped the benefits of their labor."
I've just seen something. I don't know what is it in the Greek. You just said that the tear goes black.
Yes.
Right? I didn't realize that. And now it says, "Lift up your eyes and look at the fields, for they're already white for harvest." I've never understood that.
Yeah.
So white for harvest must mean it's kosher. I mean, it's okay. It's the real thing. Whereas if it's black, it's the tear that you've got to separate it out, and that's the way you separate out the black and the white, which is very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've never seen that. Thank you, brother.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. In the Greek, it's white. It's levke. So, yeah, there's a color involved there.
Yeah.
Which fits in nice to the judgment metaphor. Good and the bad is usually white and black.
Right.
For...
And
light and darkness.
Does it tie up with Isaiah?
Also, one other reference before we go on. Matthew 9:35 talks about Jesus going in all the towns and doing his ministry. And it says, he says to his disciples in verse 37, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field." So what's kind of the big picture of all of this? How do we summarize the harvest? What's being harvested? And what's it represent? And it seems most of these metaphors.
There's a judgment.
There's a separation between good and evil. Mm-hmm. And
there seems to be things that they have done that are morally bad. They're going to be judged.
Well, all these things will be revealed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's going to come clear in the end.
It's
ticking. Or when you're in judgment.
It's ticking. Probably the famous one, somebody brought up Revelation with the harvest judgment. Let's look at Revelation 14. Revelation 14:14. "I looked, and there before me was a white cloud, and seated on the cloud was one like a son of man, with a crown of gold on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand." And, you know, so here we have this sickle again, like Joel, you know, put the sickle in and harvest, right? Joel says, so Revelation 14, verse 15 says, "Then another angel came out of the temple and called in a loud voice to him who was sitting on the cloud." That's another interesting connection, because in Joel, it's talking about Jerusalem a lot, Zion, and the Lord dwells there. And at the end of the day, what it really means is he dwells in the temple. It's just a euphemism for, why is Jerusalem special? It's because of the temple. So this angel comes out of the temple and called in a loud voice to him who was sitting on the cloud. Take your sickle and reap, because the time to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. So he who was seated on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was harvested. Another angel came out of the temple, and this kind of also reminds me of Joel 3, because Joel is basically, in 3 is harvesting the nations, the goyim, but in a bad way. Verse 17, another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. Still another angel, who had charge of the fire, came from the altar and called in a loud voice to him who had a sharp sickle, "Take your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of grapes from the earth's vine, because its grapes are ripe." The angel swung his sickle on the earth, gathered its grapes, and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. They were trampled in the winepress outside the city. This is where I think David Bogenreith was talking about. My eyes have seen the coming of the glory of the Lord. I think it's from here in Revelation. They were trampled in the winepress outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press, rising as high as the horses' bridles for a distance of 1,600 stadia, which is maybe 300 kilometers. I don't know. So in all of these, we have a harvest going on. And it seems like Revelation is also alluding back to Joel, where he's talking about nations, Gentiles. And,
you know, what is so strong, isn't it, is that we as believers find it very hard to really come to terms with the wrath of God. We get so caught up in God is love and God is gracious, and all of which is true. But it's two sides. And there is a wrath. And whether it's in Joel or whether it's here, we're talking about a wrath of God that is going to separate good and bad, that is going to separate.
So let's finish with 1 Corinthians 15, which we talked earlier about Paul. Let's end with some encouragement from the apostle on this whole idea of harvest and how Jesus plays into it and how we're part of that harvest. 1 Corinthians 15:20. But Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. Because if you remember the context of Corinthians, everybody's, Jesus is risen from the dead. There's a whole movement going on, and people are excited because they see miracles happening. They see the Holy Spirit moving. But then people start dying. And I'm like, well, so-and-so died. And thought Jesus was going to come back, or I thought, you know, like the end was here within a year or two or three, and now people are starting to die. Right, like what does that mean? Did we misunderstand what he said? And so Paul's here talking about the resurrection of the dead at the end of his letter to the Corinthians. So he's affirming Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For since death came through a man, the resurrection of the dead comes also through a man. For as in Adam all die, so in Christ all will be made alive, but each in his own turn. So, you know, we're all going to die, but it's like we're waiting in line. It's a process. But when he comes, those who belong to him are part of Christ. Verse 24. Then the end will come when he hands over the kingdom to God the Father after he has destroyed all dominion, authority, and power. For he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death. And that kind of makes me think again of Joel 3, where he's going to destroy all dominion, authority, and power, and death. Kind of the idea of your enemies, those who are coming up to attack, that there is this judgment. So So then skip down to verse 35. But someone may ask, how are the dead raised? With what kind of body will they come? How foolish, what you sow does not come to life until it dies, unless it dies. When you sow, you do not plant the body that will be, but just a seed, perhaps of wheat or of something else. But God gives it a body as he has determined, and to each kind of seed he gives its own body. So that whole idea of farming, of planting a seed, you know, it's stuck in the ground, you don't see it, it's literally buried like you would a dead body, and then life comes from it a month or 2 months later. And, you know, people are like, well, how does that happen? And it's kind of, it's the same idea of eternal life. That's kind of the image Paul's painting here. And then to finish, go to verse 42. So will it be with the resurrection of the dead. The body that is sown is perishable. It is raised imperishable. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, and it is raised a spiritual body. So basically, just to finish, you know, this whole idea of harvest, it, you know, it's a hard thing to kind of come to grips with judgment, because especially today, judgment, as Jim was saying, judgment's not politically correct, and I know, I'm just echoing your words, but we live in a world of judgment. Things all the time are being born and are dying, and we don't understand why locusts show up in our lives at different points. And death is really kind of like a metaphor of that why did it happen then to so and so? And what's important, like Paul's focus is it's, you know, you've got to look at the big picture of the harvest, that we are part of this harvest. The world is a part of this harvest. And however you want to call that, God's judgment, God's sovereignty, where he's in control and he makes the decisions. It's not our decision making in the valley of judgment or the valley of decision. It's God's decision.
And if anyone ever goes with valley of gold, but that's too positive.
That's right. She's talking about Harut. Okay, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. I love verse 6 here. It says, foolish one, what you sow is not made alive until it dies.
Right.
I mean, that's the bottom line.
Right.
We think, oh, we're sowing this, we're gaining all the time.